KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The United States is deepening its military involvement in Afghanistan following President Trump's pledge last week to send more troops to aid Afghan security forces. At 9, we discuss the 16-year-old war and what the United States can hope to achieve. And then at 9:30, we'll talk to UC Berkeley Energy Professor Dan Kamen about Hurricane Harvey, climate change, and why he recently resigned from his position as State Department science envoy. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump announced a new military strategy for Afghanistan last week, promising to send more U.S. troops to train and support Afghan security forces and demanding that Pakistan do more to counter Islamic militant groups in the region. The president characterized his strategy as a departure from that of past administrations, saying that the United States is not nation-building, but rather, quote, killing terrorists. We'll discuss the 16-year-old Afghan war in this opening segment, the longest military operation in U.S. history, and what the U.S. hopes to achieve at this stage. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Stephen Biddle. He's professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University. Also serves as adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen Biddle, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And let me thank also Andrew Wilder, who's joining us for this segment, also from the nation's capital, Vice President of Asia Programs with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Good morning, Andrew Wilder.
Good morning. Good to be on the show.
Good to have you with us. Let me begin, Stephen Biddle, if I may, with you. And let's just talk, first of all, about what's new in this strategy, other than what I indicated was concern about Pakistan and its role, and really the president coming down pretty hard on Pakistan, and I want to flesh that out more and maybe giving more encouragement to India. But let's just go right to number of troops. We've got 8,400 now, and there's been talk about authorization going up to around 12,400, but we really don't have specific numbers here. And what's new about this strategy? Just more troops or more killing of terrorists?
Yeah, what's new is mostly a change of degree. The basic strategy for the war still amounts to maintain a military stalemate while seeking a negotiated political settlement. That's pretty much been the strategy for the war for years now. What's different here, to the extent that there's anything different, is somewhat more military investment in maintaining the stalemate, somewhat more pressure on Pakistan to reduce their support for the Taliban, a kind of a reaffirmation that calendar-based deadlines were a bad idea, but the Obama administration had given up on that as well, so that's not literally new. The Obama administration had been pressuring Pakistan to try and reduce their support for the Taliban. That's not literally new. There were some vague hints that we might play the India card, which, if we were actually to do it, could very easily be counterproductive rather than helpful, but it's not clear whether we're actually going to do it. So mostly what we're talking about are changes at the margin in what amounts to the strategy that we've had now for some years.
Well, there was an invitation to India to be more involved, and actually President really threatened Pakistan, punished them for harboring insurgents. It caused a great deal of consternation throughout Pakistan, and he also said he would cut aid if they didn't do more. I mean, I don't know if this is considered different in many ways, but it certainly seems to be.
Well, but the United States has been trying to pressure Pakistan to cut back on their aid to the Taliban for years, and yet, since the Obama administration took office, if not before. So the form that the pressure takes changes from year to year. And in the past, we've been reluctant to explicitly threaten the Pakistanis with bringing the Indians into Afghanistan in a major way, in part because we're afraid that that would be, you know, a third rail kind of move that would cause the Pakistanis to dig in their heels rather than cooperate. But it's not clear that the administration is actually going to do that. You know, Trump, for better or worse, seems quite fond of making blue sky negotiating positions and vague but dire threats that he doesn't seem to think he's bound by. So it's unclear to me what, if anything, will actually come of that.
Well, Andrew Wilder, if there is going to be some kind of political resolution or the possibility of a political resolution, presumably the Taliban is going to have to be involved in this. And presumably that would have to move the Taliban forward in some way. And I mean, I think you've gone on record as saying there's really no way to defeat them or drive them out or outlast them. So how do we come to a political resolution with them?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between the counterterrorism mission, which has actually largely been successful in Afghanistan in terms of eliminating the threat of al-Qaeda from Afghanistan and keeping ISIS presence to sort of a minimum. So I think, and that I think, counterterrorism effort needs to continue. But I think the much existential threat in Afghanistan is the Taliban insurgency. And I think that's where, there isn't a military solution there, and I think most of our generals there would also say the same. I mean, if with 140,000 international troops we couldn't, defeat the Taliban insurgency, we're not going to do it with 12,000 or 15,000 international.
Well, President Obama at one point had 100,000, but I'm just wondering to what extent this can be pushed toward some kind of resolution of any kind. I realize that a lot of the reason the troop increase is there is to essentially fill the vacuum or respond to the vacuum that would be filled up by al-Qaeda and getting sanctuary there again, or for that matter, by ISIS. But the Taliban is really the big player here.
Well, I would agree. And that's why the president's speech focused very much on the military strategy and about killing terrorists and not doing nation building. I would actually argue we need to be focusing much more on a political strategy. And I think really for the last 16 years, we've been much more clear on a military strategy and not very clear on the political strategy. And I think that's where I think there is an opportunity. Whether it'll be seized, I'm not sure. But I think the fact that, one change from the Obama position was, Obama's policies were leaving Afghanistan. I think, now we've signaled actually we're not leaving right away, and we're going to have a modest increase on the military side. And that could be used to incentivize the Taliban to come to the negotiating table, because there's not the incentive that we're leaving next year, and so might as well sit us out. Combined with a regional strategy, which will also be critically important to, I think, get some kind of politically negotiated end to the conflict. But I think that's where we do need to see more focus on the U.S. side and really articulating our interest in a politically negotiated end to the conflict there. And we didn't hear that from the president so much, although Secretary Tillerson did elaborate on that in his statement after the president's speech.
We have a political solution that's plausible. I mean, you've had such corrupt governments, presently under Ashraf Ghani, and even before that under Karzai. And they're, by the way, in total disagreement about this latest strategy. Apparently Ghani favors it, and Karzai is in strong opposition, says more war than we need, somehow peace and prosperity, too much killing. But they were both pretty corrupt regimes, and we're facing some kind of almost interminable war here. It's 16 years.
Yeah, well, will it be easy? No. I mean, is it a certainty we'll be successful? No. I think what was, from my perspective, some of the alternatives being, discussed were worse. I mean, an immediate withdrawal of the U.S. military presence, I think, would nearly inevitably have led to a collapse of the Afghan state, which, as flawed as it is and as much as it suffers from corruption, it still functions. We have an Afghan National Security Forces, which are fighting hard at tremendous cost, but still, they've been losing ground, but they've held all the major capitals. And so as bad as the situation is, I mean, having worked in Afghanistan in the 80s and 90s, I can assure you it can get much worse. And so, but what I would argue is we've never really been very explicit on a politically negotiated end to the conflict is really a key objective of the U.S. and Afghanistan. And I think if we focus on that, I think it's going to be difficult, no guarantees of success, but I think it's possible that a combination of the regional actors, China playing a greater role, and I would also argue that the Afghan government does need to play its part, but I think, President Ghani actually is a reformer at heart, and he's making some difficult decisions to move a reform agenda forward, including in the security institutions. So So progress is being made on that front, so I don't think it's altogether hopeless.
Well, we should mention that China has come out in strong opposition to the latest move by President Trump, and we're talking about Afghanistan with Stephen Biddle and with Andrew Wilder, and we do invite your calls and emails. In fact, we'd like to hear from you and your thoughts about what's moving forward now under the Trump administration vis-a-vis Afghanistan. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We invite you to join the program and the conversation. Any questions or comments you have are welcome. Again, you can call us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Please feel free to join the program. And let me go back, if I may, Stephen Biddle, to you. There was an opinion editorial in the New York Times by Eric Prince. Eric Prince is a Navy SEAL. He's also chair of Frontier Services and founded a company that was formerly known as Blackwater, a very well-known company for its security contractors. And he says that there's a whole other option here, not troops, but contractors. He was talking about the Flying Tigers back in fighting Japanese aggression in China. In other words, get paid volunteers rather than the military and don't denigrate them as mercenaries. Just get them to do the job that needs to be done. Use them in special operations forces, particularly those who have had experience militarily in Afghanistan. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, in public policy, most coins have two sides, but I think this one only has one. There's very little upside to this proposal. The basic problem militarily with conducting the war is a deep-seated issue of corruption and cronyism in the Afghan military, which is the kind of problem you see in lots of developing world militaries and which isn't easily remediable. And substituting private contractor advisors for uniformed U.S. military advisors changes nothing except the political visibility of the war in Washington, by reducing a war that's almost invisible already to a war that's actually invisible. It's not clear why that's a good idea. I mean, aside from the fact that it's very unlikely to move the ball forward on the ground militarily in Afghanistan, the whole thrust of the proposal is to make the democratic accountability for waging a war lower than it is already by making, you know, essentially U.S. military action invisible. And It escapes me what the positive contribution of this proposal would be. Now, to put it mildly, it's not new to have contractors in Afghanistan. There are vastly more contractors there than there are uniformed military right now. So what Prince is proposing would add a few more, change their mission profile a bit, and it's not clear that any of that, you know, changes the situation and the strategic prognosis in any meaningful way. I don't see a lot of upside in it.
Well, Andrew Wilder, you spoke of hope in this. We've got over 12,000 NATO troops in addition to American troops that are doing training and advising and so forth. And it seems from many perspectives as if we're in a kind of war that has no end to it. And the Taliban have said they want to continue to make Afghanistan into a graveyard. Where's the upside?
Well, again, as I said, I wouldn't necessarily say that there's an upside right now. I think if we can focus on being clear that we want a politically negotiated settlement, then there's actually, that's the way to end the war, I think, responsibly. And, you know, I think President Trump would like to, and most Americans would like to withdraw our troops from Afghanistan. Well, that's actually the same objective of the Taliban. They want to withdraw us to withdraw our troops, and most of Afghanistan's neighbors want us to withdraw our troops, although they don't want us to do it precipitously, leading to Afghan state collapse. So there's actually some common ground there around which I think you can actually have a negotiating process. But if the U.S. policy is, well, we're going to withdraw our troops by the end of the year, well, why negotiate?
Let me bring in our
So I think I'm that's sorry. The key thing is to signal again that we want, with the Taliban, a politically negotiated end to the solution and really work towards that. But if we fail, I actually think we might need to, you know, stay on as the status quo, because if we pull out all our troops and it does collapse, I certainly have no doubts that Afghanistan will become again, a safe haven for transnational terrorist groups that threaten the U.S. I mean, precisely when we're actually pushing ISIS to some degree out of Syria and Iraq, I don't think we want to then create an opportunity for them to move into in larger numbers into Afghanistan.
Yeah, of course, big questions are, can you get the Taliban to the table and can you trust the Taliban? But let me go to our callers, and we begin, Sikander, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. So, yeah, I just wanted to make a point that the view coming out of Pakistan lately has been that it has paid a big economic cost and a big cost in terms of tens of thousands of lives lost in this whole sort of operation over the last 10, 15 years. So there seems to be a sort of, you know, pushback on this U.S. policy, and China has come out in favor of Pakistan too, or its viewpoint, it seems. So how much leverage does the U.S. really have, given that the aid has dwindled over the last decade quite significantly? And is there a risk of pushing them, too far and sort of stopping that dialogue with them?
That's a good question. Stephen Biddle.
I think the United States has insufficient leverage. The Pakistanis believe that this is an existential, vital national interest for them, and that's understandable. Afghanistan is right on the other side of a very porous international border. Chaos in Afghanistan could destabilize a Pakistan that's in the middle of its own civil war, even as we speak. For the United States to put enough leverage on Pakistan to persuade them to make decisions that they think threaten the viability of their own state, we would need either a huge amount of aid on the upside or some really grave threat on the downside. I think this administration seems to think that threatening to bring India into Afghanistan would provide the latter. Again, as I suggested earlier, I think the problem is the threatening them with downside costs in an environment that they themselves see as a vital national security interest is as likely to produce pushback as it is cooperation.
And let me thank.
I'm skeptical that we're going to get Pakistan to change its policy.
Let me thank the caller. I want to get to another caller right away. Weiss, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Weiss. I'm calling from Dublin. I'm an Afghan, and I would like to comment on the situation in Afghanistan. How is it possible for the Afghan government and the United States to bring in peace to Afghanistan and enter this conflict when the Afghan president himself, he used corruption to come to power? At the same time, his government is full of people that are sympathizing the terrorists and the Taliban. And the Ashraf Ghani himself, he used terrorism to intimidate his opponents in power. I'm following the Afghan media all the time since I am an Afghan, and I see all the time these Taliban sympathizers on television. Every time a terrorist attack happens in Afghanistan, they're supporting it on Afghan television, and these people are part of the current Afghan government.
Now, you raise a central question. Let me actually go to Andrew Wilder on this. Again, we get to the core of the fact that Afghan governments have been corrupt and continue to be corrupt, and they're mainly centered in Kabul, while there are all these factions throughout the country. I don't know how you sit down and negotiate with a corrupt government. Andrew Wilder?
Well, I mean, we've often negotiated with corrupt governments, and insurgencies have often negotiated with corrupt governments, so this will not be the first time. And so certainly corruption has been a major problem, and as Stephen Biddle said, in the Afghan national security forces. I would say, though, that, an effort is being made now to change that. And, it's not going to be overnight, but we are seeing significant action taken against our senior generals in the Afghan army who were, found guilty of corruption. Large numbers of the generals have been replaced with more junior officers being promoted into those ranks. We see a very reform-oriented attorney general in Afghanistan for the first time who's making a sincere effort to try to clean up a very corrupt attorney general's office in Afghanistan. We're seeing reforms in terms of the civil service. And so, again, long ways to go, but efforts are being made. And as part of the new strategy, there is this Kabul Compact, which actually does make clear, look, it's not the Afghan government has to do heavy lifting in this, too. It's not just up to the U.S. and our NATO allies to be, fighting the insurgency. The Afghan government has to push a reform agenda forward. And in particular, I think, also needs to make efforts to ensure the 2019 presidential election is better than the 2014 presidential election. Because if we don't end up with a legitimate president emerging or a legitimate government after that, then we also have a major problem in our hands in terms of sort of who's going to control the security forces. And I mean, this is one of my criticisms of the strategy and President Trump's sort of dismissal that we're not there to do nation building or to really promote democracies. Well, I would actually argue that we need to actually strengthen state institutions and actually have a democratic process, because that's our exit strategy for Afghanistan, is to have a relatively effective state institutions that can run the country so that we can leave.
There's a tweet from a listener named Harrison who says it's time to get out. I should mention, by the way, just a fact and a fact to digest is that about 1,250 bombs and weapons in the first 7 months here in Afghanistan of this year. That's twice the number from last year. Let me go to another caller and let's get William on. William, you're on.
Thank you very much. I'm intrigued by something that seems to be happening here that I've heard happen similarly before. On the one hand, as you know, the United States has recently declared that it's going after China on some economic issues in the World Trade Organization or whatever. They're going to punish China. On the other hand, as the guest pointed out, we're saying to China, oh, come help us here in Afghanistan, or come help us here in North Korea issue. Could they comment on that apparent contradiction?
Stephen Biddle?
Well, I mean, linkage is kind of an everyday issue in international politics. So countries like China and the United States have a dense web of interactions. In some of them, we want things from the other party, and others, the other party wants things from us. So I don't think there's anything particularly unique about the U.S.-China situation right now with respect to the general problem of linkage. I think with respect to Afghanistan in particular, it's very unlikely that Chinese assistance is going to change the situation in any consequential way.
Well, there's a comment here that's apropos from one of our listeners who says, this is Jake who writes, we get daily threats from North Korea because China supports a boy king. Something that the people of the United States must realize deeply is that the two big problems, North Korea and North Pakistan, are problems caused by the negligence of other countries. We can't do it alone. And Skip writes, let me go to you in this, Andrew Wilder. We've got little time left, but I'd like to hear your reaction. He says, what happens to the opium grown in Afghanistan? Is the war all about the opium poppy as the Iraq war was about oil?
I certainly don't think it's all about it, but certainly the criminal economy of Afghanistan is one of the key things that's also fueling the war. I mean, lots of vested interests. There are vested in maintaining the status quo because many people are making money both out of the war economy, and opium plays a key role in that.
Well, we're going to have to unfortunately conclude this discussion. We will continue to follow a new military strategy for Afghanistan that, as I said, was announced last week by President Trump, promising to send more U.S. troops to train and support Afghan security forces. Let me thank you, Stephen Biddle, Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University. Good to have you with us. Appreciate your being with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Andrew Wilder. Andrew Wilder is Vice President of Asia Programs with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Good to have you with us, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are coming up on another forum segment. Dan Kamen is going to join us in the segment ahead. Professor of Energy at UC Berkeley, who resigned in an acrostic that said impeach from being a science envoy to the U.S. Department of State. We'll hear from him when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.